More than a million students in Michigan headed back to school today amidst debates over education. One central question: what makes a good teacher? And how should we measure that teacher's success and effectiveness? Education writer Elizabeth Green explores these questions in her new book, Building a Better Teacher: How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you have reported about education for years, and for this book, you watched teachers in action, you looked at education programs in different colleges and universities, and I'm wondering, what do you think is a great teacher?
That's true. I've reported on education for a long time, and I thought that I knew some things about it, but I started to realize after all that observing of teachers that I hadn't understood something important, which is that I had assumed that there were just good teachers and bad teachers, and there were some secret characteristics that made good teachers good right from the get-go. But what I came to see is that really great teachers are people who learn to do great teaching. They're people who have access to opportunities to learn, and there's no silver bullet personality trait that can determine who that's going
to
be.
Yeah, in fact, your book really tries to shoot a torpedo broadside into that idea that a good teacher is born. What is so pernicious about this myth of the natural born teacher?
I think the issue is that we understandably look at great teachers and think about what we see, what's visible. And it seems like what's visible is some kind of charisma, a way of connecting with students. But in fact, you can be an extrovert or an introvert and you can still be a great teacher. That's not what matters. It's really much more about specialized knowledge and skill. And the problem with assuming that some teachers are just born great and some teachers aren't is that by assuming that, we fail to prepare teachers with that specialized knowledge that nobody is born knowing how to do. And as a result, we leave students vulnerable to teachers who haven't learned the basic things they need to know to help those students learn.
Why do you think this whole natural-born teacher myth has become such a core belief in America? Who was pushing this?
I think that one of the reasons is that it's not so easy to figure out what does make a great teacher. And also, you know, there's not been a lot of support for the study of teaching as a craft. So both at the school level and at the university level, most of our focus is on pretty much anything but teaching, anything but pedagogy, as one of the characters in my book puts it when he talks about schools of education, that the places that are supposed to study this enterprise end up studying lots of other things, but not this core business. So we haven't spent the time really to see what's going on. Although in the last 20 years, there was a big change, a lot of it centered in Michigan, interestingly, that changed the way people think about this and is a big part of the book.
And talk about that. What was this big push and what was so important?
So there was a shift to focus research on education and turn it into research on teaching, and not just study teaching, but study the minds of teachers. And that was centered in East Lansing, Michigan, when Judy Lanier, who is the dean of the College of Education at Michigan State University, created this new institute for research on teaching along with Lee Shulman, and the two of them together really created a revolution in the way we understand what teachers do by saying, let's study not just teachers' behaviors, but let's study their minds. And when they opened that up, they were able to see that what teaching takes is actually a special kind of knowledge. It's decisions right in the moment. You have to understand not just what the right answer to a problem is, but all the ways a student might get the wrong answer. And then a teacher in the moment has to decide how to shape a problem, shape a discussion so that the student's understanding will change. It's such sophisticated work that these two individuals, Lee Shulman and Judy Lanier, ended up deciding that there was nothing more complicated than teaching, not even being a doctor, because whereas a doctor has one patient, a teacher has 30 students, whereas a doctor has a clear beginning and end to, you know, diagnosing the problem, solving the problem. Teachers are dealing with students' minds, and that is endlessly changing. So it's extremely complicated and really, I came to think, beautiful and inspiring work.
And I'm talking with Elizabeth Green, education writer, whose new book is Building a Better Teacher: How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. And your book, Elizabeth, focuses a lot of positive attention also on Deborah Ball, who's dean of the University of Michigan School of Education. What is Deborah doing that you think is so right?
I think what Deborah is doing is looking at the teaching profession and saying, how can we prepare teachers better so that when they come into the job, they don't have to learn everything on the job. So she says, in other professions, we would never do this when it comes to airline pilots or even hairdressers. We don't say, oh, you know, here's a head of hair. Please just do with it what you will. Learn on the job. Or here's a plane full of 30 young minds. Just figure out how to fly it. She says teaching should be just like other professions where we invest upfront in preparing teachers for the core work they need to do. And that's what she's been doing at the University of Michigan School of Education, trying to change the way teachers are prepared. And now she's been taking that work nationally. And actually, she began as the student of Lee Shulman and Judy Lanier at Michigan State. So it's a very Michigan story.
One of the big questions in education, certainly something debated in Michigan, and it's an issue across the country, is accountability. And what's the answer if a group of students is not performing up to expectations? Who should be held accountable and in what way? And so there's a couple of ways of looking at this that you disagree with. One is this accountability. So this push to rely on student testing and on-the-job evaluations and measuring which teachers are doing a good job and which aren't, a very business-like approach. What do you see is wrong with that?
There's no question that teachers are very responsible for what students learn. When researchers look at all the factors under schools' control, a teacher has the biggest role in determining what students learn. And that's not so surprising to anyone who thinks about what's actually happening. You know, who's the person responsible? The teacher. That said, I think the question is, what should we do to help that teacher and help those students ensure that they're going to reliably get good results? And I think that, as you're saying, one of the main ideas for how to solve that problem is to hold teachers accountable for what their students learn. The idea is that by creating data to say, this teacher is good, this teacher is less good, we can figure out who should remain in the classroom and who should maybe get a reward for staying and who should be removed. But while that might be one piece of the puzzle, it's sort of the idea of, in order to teach students algebra, you should give them a bunch of algebra tests. Well, there's a role for the test, but you also have to teach them algebra in the first place. And I think what's missing in the conversation is any sense of we need to help teachers learn to teach, because teaching is complicated and you can't just learn to do it by being pushed. You also need to be taught.
Going right back to this myth of the natural-born teacher and blowing that out of the water. And Elizabeth, on the other side of the coin, there's this argument that teachers are being micromanaged and they aren't given the freedom and the respect to just do their jobs. Tell us what you see is wrong with this autonomy argument.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the response to the big push for accountability is, you know, you're squashing our creativity. I need the freedom to do creative things with my students and let my professional decision-making rule the day. But that attitude has also really hurt teachers, because it means in practice that they're left alone to learn on the job this really complicated thing. So I think there's a way to say we need to give teachers professional autonomy and we need to acknowledge that they have this responsibility, but we also can find a middle ground where teachers have freedom to figure out how to teach alongside the support they need to not have to reinvent the wheel each time they step in a classroom.
And that costs money. Money
exactly.
Many districts don't have. Who can do, you know, there are so many districts that are squeezing the life out of every penny they can get. So where would that support and mentoring come from?
Oh, well, I thought you were saying it costs money to leave teachers to reinvent the wheel.
Well, that too.
It's expensive either way.
Yeah.
One interesting thing is that we, you know, this makes the story a bit more complicated, but the reality is while teachers by and large report that they're not prepared from education school to learn to actually teach, and on the job they get very little support in learning what to do, we do have, you know, professional development programs that actually we spend a lot of money on, and we do have education schools that we spend a lot of money on as a country. The question is, are those opportunities actually focused on helping people learn to teach better? And unfortunately, most of the time they're not, and teachers leave them either more confused or frustrated. But, you know, we all know that those happen. We see those days off that students have because teachers are getting professional development. A big challenge that all educators face today is how to make those opportunities more successful.
And that's what I want to kind of end on, Elizabeth, what you see as the challenges. What, you know, what should we all be doing as a society to teach our teachers to teach and then give them the right tools and support through their career? So first, what are the challenges to education schools in America today?
I think one of the big challenges at education schools is that there has been an undervaluing of research on teaching as well as teacher preparation. So the folks who are the most prestigious faculty members who get the biggest research grants are generally folks who are studying some other discipline applied to education, like the history of education, the sociology, economics of education, rather than studying what makes a great teacher? How can we improve teaching? You know, there was a huge push against that in Michigan, but we could do a lot more to extend that vision that began in East Lansing and take that to more universities. Another roadblock is the fact that in schools, in the K-12 schools, there is very little time to learn. So teachers in this country spend 1,000 hours or more a year with their students, leaving very little time for them to prepare to learn from each other. By contrast, countries that are much more competitive on international tests, those teachers have 600 hours a year only that they spend with students, almost half of the time that American teachers spend, leaving them with all of that extra time to learn to teach. So we need to create the structures that actually give teachers the time and the space and the content to learn how to teach.
What do you see as the challenge to policymakers, the legislative bodies that set policy for, let's talk about the state of Michigan. What's the challenge there?
Yeah, I think that the challenge is how can you legislate learning? How can you legislate learning? It's easier to legislate accountability, and it's easier to legislate autonomy, and it's easier to focus on the structures that maybe are not the most meaningful. It's harder to make the case for finding opportunities to help people learn, but there are basic structural changes that can be made and that do relate to policy. So the time in classrooms is a policy issue. The structure of the organization of teachers' work is a policy issue. The lack of, until recently, common standards to help teachers have a common thing that they can work on together in terms of figuring out how to help their students learn. You know, adding to our challenges has been historically the fact we don't have a shared curriculum or even a shared idea of what students are supposed to learn. So the Common Core can be embraced as one useful tool to help get to this place of where teachers can work together on the craft of teaching.
And finally, the challenge to teachers, to the folks who are standing in front of those classrooms in America.
I came away from reporting this book with so much more empathy, I think, and respect for what teachers do. I can't imagine going to work every day and not having the time to even do my job on top of the whole country seems to misunderstand what it is I'm doing there. And then at the same time, every year there's a new idea for how to do your job better and change everything. I think what the best teachers are able to do is somehow shut out all of that outside conversation and say, I'm committed to my work. I'm going to create out of nowhere the opportunities I need to be a professional who learns more and more every day. And we have to be so grateful for teachers for doing that. And we have to say, let's make it so that you don't have to do that against the grain. How can we make that something we support rather than something that is defying the odds?
Elizabeth Green, her new book is Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. Elizabeth, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.